The Buddha was very keen that we practice truthful speech, and I think we have a responsibility to check that what we're passing on is accurate.
I just had a sense of a really lovely sense of friendship. That was the thing I took away. People having had a chance to spend time together from many different traditions, sometimes really quite opposing ways of seeing the Dharma, practicing it, communicating well, and that's something that we prize very highly in Triratna, you know, friendship, communication, deep communication, kindness. It was really was a feast of kindness and appreciation.
And I've just seen how vulnerable people can become in old age. And yes, we have the Dharma, but we also need other support structures around us as well.
I think my life is so enriched by having contact with the Indian Sangha. I can't imagine my Buddhist practice without it, in a sense. It's really become part of me, and it makes me very, very happy.
Welcome to the first Buddhist Centre Online magazine podcast. I'm Sadaya Sihi, and I'll be taking you through some of our recent audio highlights. During this episode, we'll hear from Bodhi Paksha, who introduces his latest book, I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha, Mahashraddha, the director of the Abhayaratna Trust, and Vajratara, the current chair of the India Dhamma Trust. But first, to rewind to the end of September 2018, where two important meetings took place in Adishtana in Herefordshire, UK. The first was the annual gathering of the European Buddhist Union, and this was then followed by the Buddhist Teachers in Europe meeting. Manisha, Triratna's liaison officer, attended these meetings, and we'll hear now from her about how they went. But first, what is the liaison office?
The liaison office is something Bante created a number of years ago to represent Triratna at pan-Buddhist gatherings. And originally, I think it was sort of to present the Triratna way, you know, to other Buddhists. I see it very much, and so have my predecessors, seen it very much as cooperation with other Buddhists in matters of common interest, sharing insights and ways of doing things that could be helpful to each other, and campaigning on certain things as well. Like, for example, campaigning on issues such as the oppression of Muslims in Burma, Myanmar.
The first meeting that took place in Adishtana at the end of September was the European Buddhist Union, or EBU. Manisha explains what that meeting is about and what it was like having it at a retreat centre like Adishtana.
The European Buddhist Union is an umbrella group for Buddhist groups all across Europe. It generally meets, it circulates around Europe for this last weekend of September every year. It goes to sort of all sorts of glitzy places like Berlin and Vienna. And this year, it was Adishtana. So we had about 30 Buddhists of various different traditions from Italy, Switzerland, Germany, France, Spain, quite a number from Britain, all turned up at Adishtana. They absolutely loved it. And Adishtana loved them. It was great. It was particularly nice because sometimes when we meet in city centres, people have to find their own places to stay the night, and that tends to dilute the meeting. Having everybody living in a retreat centre in beautiful countryside, being looked after with nice food, and it had a very strong effect on them. Meeting. It was very harmonious, and a lot of people turned up in the shrine room. It's one of the friendliest EBU gatherings I've ever attended. I just had a sense of a really lovely sense of friendship. That was the thing I took away. People having had a chance to spend time together from many different traditions, sometimes really quite opposing ways of seeing the Dharma, practicing it, communicating well. And that's something that we prize very highly in Triratna, you know, friendship, communication, deep communication, kindness. Kindness from the Adishtana community and kindness from the guests. It really was a feast of kindness and appreciation.
And just following on that theme of appreciation, one EBU participant, an Italian Buddhist, wrote later to say, "I really love to be in Adishtana. It's a place where you can feel the Dharma everywhere." Interestingly, a lot of the attendees at the EBU were quite keen to meet with Sangharakshita, or Bante, as he's also known, the founder of the Triratna Buddhist Order and community who lived at Adishtana. And of course, Sangharakshita died less than a month later, which adds a certain poignancy and is perhaps even a reminder to us to make the most of every opportunity.
People were queuing up to meet Bante. You know, he's the last of his generation, the sort of really European pioneer Buddhists of the 1960s. Lots of young Buddhists as well from other traditions were invited because the other theme was young Buddhists. And they also wanted to meet Bante, and a lot of them brought presents with them for Bante. The sweetest one was a little, you know, matchbox-sized musical box that played Beethoven's Ode to Joy, which is also the European national anthem. It was brought by the president of the Austrian Buddhist Union because he knew that Bante couldn't see. The president of the Norwegian Buddhist Union, who is a bit of a scholar, in the closing circle, when people said how they felt about the weekend, he said that he had met Bante in the 1970s and never met him again until today, closing day, and that this had been the highlight of his weekend and that he would not forget it for the rest of his life. He described Bante as a towering pioneer of Western Buddhism. It obviously had a huge effect on him.
So what was discussed at the European Buddhist Union?
One of the themes of the meeting was ethical standards, codes of conduct in sanghas, because there have been quite a lot of scandals, particularly to do with sexual abuse in sanghas in this last couple of years. So the president of the Dutch Buddhist Union talked about how they have worked slowly over a number of years of towards having a whole raft of ethical policies, a condition of membership of the Dutch Buddhist Union. And then I followed that by talking about how we actually do it in Tri Ratna and explaining the difference between internal ethical guidelines, which we have, and safeguarding documents, which are a requirement of British charities, which are more like external requirements, which have to do with, you know, showing awareness of the law on equalities legislation and discrimination and sexual crime. And how those complement each other. Because this is unknown in other countries, people were very, very interested, and they were saying, this is fantastic. You know, can you share your documents with us? Because nobody wants to reinvent the wheel. There was just an incredible appreciation of everything we've done to look at this area of ethics. Not a hint of criticism or suspicion. And then they thought that they would set up some kind of EBU committee for developing a whole load of model documents for all the Buddhist organizations in Europe to use if they want, just so we can really all together, you know, make huge strides, progress. I did help the EBU draft a statement about their concern, their collective concern about widespread sexual misconduct across various sanghas and the need for us all to come together to take measures to combat this and to comfort the victims. And then Pranyaketu was there, who is the Tri Ratna Young Buddhist Coordinator, because the other theme was how do sanghas encourage inclusion of younger Buddhists, because all sanghas are encountering the same problems, that they're struggling to stay relevant to young people, relevant and attractive to modern young people. So they invited a number of young Buddhist guests, and not just to listen, but also to, you know, contribute. And Pranyaketu was the key speaker on that. He was very, very good, I must say. He's a great gift to Tri Ratna. And they all cooperated on a statement about young Buddhists, and they also spent some time together without the rest of us planning for future cooperative events, which was interesting because we've never done that before in Tri Ratna.
So all in all, the European Buddhist Union was a success, both in terms of cooperation between different Buddhist organizations around themes of mutual interest, as well as exemplifying a positive, friendly atmosphere. If you'd like to find out more about inter-Buddhist initiatives, check out thebuddhistcenter.com/liaison. That's LIAISON. So the second meeting at Adishtana was the teachers' gathering, where Bante had a chance to catch up with an old friend.
The teachers' meeting is very small by comparison with the European Buddhist Union meeting. And every third year, they have a large gathering of lots of leading European teachers. But in between, they tend to have rather small, informal discussion groups. So we were only about eight people sitting in the room. This year, they chose to have a topic of Buddhists engaging with contemporary European societies. So it's a very informal discussion gathering, really. There were a couple of talks on the two mornings to which Bante came, which was lovely. It's very rarely unable to, you know, to engage in such things, but because it was literally, 10 metres from his house, he could be pushed across in his wheelchair into the lecture hall at Adishtana and sit there for an hour listening to a talk. The first talk was by Karol Roloff, who is actually a Tibetan nun, but she's also a professor of religious studies, I think, at Hamburg University. And the second talk was by Bante's old friend, Lama Shenpen Hukam, who is a lama in the Tibetan tradition, who lives in North Wales. And they had first met in when she was 20. She's 72 now. She was absolutely delighted to spend time with him. Both of them were delighted, although she has her own sangha and, you know, is obviously a very well-regarded senior lama. She said she was extremely honoured to spend time sitting with Bante, whom she'd hardly met for the last 50 years. But he was her first teacher. She went a different direction in the end, but He was her first teacher. She was married to a man called Mike Hookham, who was one of Bante describes them as the Three Musketeers in his memoirs, who became a lama as well. He became Rigdzin Shikpo, who runs another sangha. But so they had a sort of little sense of the very early English Buddhist sangha.
So yes, there's a little taste of UK Buddhist history. In a series of messages that were received from Buddhists beyond Sri Ratna after Bante's death in October, this message was received from Lama Shenpen Hukum. "I've just returned from Adishtana, where I spent half an hour meditating beside Bante's body, feeling the powerful and strangely joyful sense of his presence as he lay there at peace with his legacy continuing all around him. It felt a privilege to be there and to spend hours in the shrine room meditating alongside so many order members, among whom I have so many good friends. The whole event has left a deep and lasting impression on me." So that was Lama Shenpen Hukum. Now, staying on the theme of death, we'll now hear from Maha Shraddha, the director of the Abhaya Ratna Trust.
My mum recently died of cancer, and my dad has been in and out of hospital since that death. And I've just seen how vulnerable people can become in old age. And yes, we have the Dharma, but we also need other support structures around us as well. And I'm very keen that the Abhaya Ratna Trust is part of putting those structures in place to allow people to really care for each other. You know, this is not theoretical. This is how it is. It's life. Sickness and aging are not very challenging.
Maha Shraddha was appointed the director of the Abhaya Ratna Trust last April. Here he explains what the Trust offers in terms of supports to order members.
Currently, the major activity of the Abhaya Ratna Trust is to support order members who either apply to us for specific amounts of money, less than £1,000. If they require more than £1,000, we generally run an appeal for those individual order members. As we explore the issues with them, it might become clear that the actual root of the issue is deeper than money itself. And the Abhaya Ratna Trust team, myself, Jinavamsa and Tara Darkany in particular, will work with them and their friends to help develop more support around the root issue.
The Abhaya Ratna Trust has a number of ambitious and far-reaching plans in the pipeline. Here, Maha Shraddha outlines a few of them.
There's two projects which are going to be launched this year. First of all, there's the Local Care Networks project, whereby the Abhaya Ratna Trust will help local situations set up local care networks, which will keep an eye out for local order members. So what that entails will be key people at a particular centre. It might be the chair, it might be the mitrakun, it might be the local order convener, kind of form a nucleus of responsible order members. And around them will be a Abhaya Ratna Trust rep, and also people who have got skills which they're willing to give to help order members in need. It might be financial management, it might be driving order members to hospital appointments, whatever. The local sangha can create a database of what the local sangha can offer to people in need. Alongside that is developing a Abhaya Trust rep networks, an international network. So ideally we'd like at least one Abhaya Ratna Trust rep in each centre or group who can work with the local care network to keep an eye out for local order members. I'd also like to mention one other project which I think will really start to take off in 2020, and that is co-housing. I've visited the Lilac project in Leeds, which is an example of a very successful co-housing project in which an order member, Jyotini, lives in. And I was very, very impressed with how things are run there. For example, each household has an allotment. There's communal washing facilities, laundry facilities, cooking facilities. And also there's a project in Cambridge which is getting off the ground. Tejasvini and others are involved in that. Savannah project. As more and more order members reach old age, then the need, I think, for co-housing or some kind of housing project is going to increase.
On a side note, the Suvanna co-housing project Maha Shraddha refers to is an initiative from a group of order members and mitras in Cambridge. Suvanna meaning happy realm. So its plan is to create newly built, sustainable, low-carbon footprint housing with a community inspired by Buddhist values. And there will also be a mix of owner-occupiers, people renting, and almshouses too. If you're interested, you can find out more by emailing suvanacohousing@gmail.com. That's suvana.cohousing@gmail.com. So now back to Mahashraddha. So Mahashraddha went to see Bhante last summer to talk to him about the Abhayaratna Trust and his new directorship, and in particular, the lecture that Bhante gave called A Case of Dysentery, which was given in 1982. And this lecture forms the ethos of the trust.
The Case of Dysentery is a story in the Pali Canon whereby the Buddha and Ananda are wandering around, and they come across this group of monks, and they see that one of the monks is very, very ill with dysentery. The Buddha says, "Why are you not looking after this monk?" The reply, amongst other things, is that, "Well, he's useless to us." So the Buddha and Ananda go to the monk's cell, and they clean him down. And then the Buddha comes out and delivers a very firm discourse, I think, to the monk, saying, "Look, you've only got each other. You've got to look after each other. You've gone forth from family and the normal structures of support. You must look after each other." The spirit of the case of dysentery, the spirit of care and concern for each other, is the founding principle of the Abhayaratna Trust. So I went to see Bhante just to talk to him about those principles, and also his lecture, A Case of Dysentery, and I asked him specifically whether he'd like to add any key points to those he made in that lecture, and he leant back in his chair, and he said, "No, the points I made are just as relevant now as what they were over 20 years ago, and I have nothing more to add. We must look after each other because we are a spiritual community, and we have left to a lesser or greater extent traditional environments of support." And he said, "I am very, very grateful to all the care I've been given in this last year, which has made it one of the happiest of my life." So Bhante himself was a recipient of that principle of care, looking after each other. The monk in the case of dysentery is regarded as useless by his fellow monks in the Sangha, and that's what one reason maybe why they left him to wallow on the floor. And Bhante was warning against the seduction of being useful at the expense of one's spiritual life and integrity and effectiveness. But also the principles of the case of dysentery, they are unconditional love. They are a full expression of the first precept of you love somebody not because what they do or give you, you love them. Yes, and again, that's one of the principles of the Bhayaratna Trust, is that we help whoever applies to us.
The lecture, A Case of Dysentery, can be found on freebuddhistaudio.com, and it is part of a lecture series called Incidences from the Pali Canon, which goes into stories from the life of the Buddha. Of course, given that all the stories we have about the Buddha were passed down by word of mouth, not written down until many hundreds of years after the Buddha's death, this raises the question, how do we know what is true and what isn't? And more particularly, how do we know what the Buddha actually said? Bodhi Paksha attempts to address this in his latest book, I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha, which explores the idea of fake Buddha quotes. Here he explains the genesis of this book.
I guess it started quite a number of years ago on Twitter. There was myself and another order member started chatting about how many fake quotes we saw floating around, you know, being attributed to the Buddha. And to us, it was just so obvious that this was not the kind of thing that the Buddha said, or these were not the kind of things that the Buddha said. And we were a little bit kind of, you know, mocking about it. And then I had a blog at that time, a personal blog, and I started collecting some of these quotes, you know, just in a state of bafflement, really, about how people could take sometimes some really weird stuff and think that the Buddha said it. And then I started just expanding on that and explaining how you could tell that this wasn't the kind of thing that the Buddha said, and giving some examples of things that he did actually say, and trying to track down these quotes and track down their origin if I possibly could. And then I had so many of those on my blog, someone suggested one day, hey, you should maybe have a dedicated blog. So I did that, and I had a fake Buddha quotes site. And then that led to a number of magazine articles in Tricycle, Buddha Dharma magazine, and eventually a book.
Sayings from people such as Osho, Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh, Robert Louis Stevenson, Marie Curie, even quotes originating from the film Fight Club have been attributed at various times to the Buddha. So there are a lot of fake Buddha quotes out there, but let's have an example.
I mean, here's one. Ennui has made more gamblers than avarice, more drunkards than thirst, and perhaps as many suicides as despair. If you're at all familiar with the Buddha scriptures, you just immediately know that that's not the kind of thing that the Buddha said. You know, the theme of ennui was not exactly big 2,500 years ago in India. And he didn't use those kinds of very elegant phrases. Well, we don't know how he taught, actually, but the Buddhist scriptures, which are the only records we actually have, don't tend to be very elegant. They tend to be rather stilted and repetitive, whereas this is obviously something quite literary. If you hear that, you probably assume it was written in maybe the 1700s or the 1800s or something, which is actually the case.
How does a quote get falsely attributed to the Buddha?
Sometimes it's a bit mysterious about how these fake Buddha quotes arise. I mean, sometimes there are kind of good reasons for it. Like, there's two books in particular that have given rise to a lot of fake Buddha quotes. One is a book by Jack Kornfield called The Buddha's Little Instruction Book. It's a book of short quotes, and people will see the title of the book and assume that it's a collection of quotes from the Buddhist scriptures. But actually, if you read the description of the book, it's Jack Kornfield's adaptation and distillation of, well, various things, actually, not just quotes from the Buddha, but quotes from other people as well. He's like tried to find nice little pithy spiritual sayings. And there's another book, which is a Japanese work. It's the kind of Japanese equivalent of the Gideon Bible. You'll find it in apparently every Japanese hotel room. And it's called The Teaching of Buddha. And again, people seeing that title will tend to assume that anything that's in that book is the word of the Buddha. So people see these essays, they pick a nice quote from it, they put it somewhere with the tag underneath The Teaching of Buddha, and then maybe someone sees that and thinks, oh, well, I'll simplify that. I'll just say it was the Buddha. And other times I think people are just messing with us. You know, they just see a quote and think, oh, yeah, okay, I'll just stick the Buddha on the end of that. And, you know, I'll look nice and wise because I'm quoting the Buddha.
Of course, given that we're dealing with an oral tradition, this raises the thorny question of how do we ever know what the Buddha actually said?
You can tell, actually, it's at least some of the quotes that are in the Dhammapada are not things that the Buddha originally said. There's one, for example, where he's talking about health and what true health is, and somebody else quotes that in another sutta, and the Buddha refers to it and says that it's not something that he originally said, it's an ancient saying that he's just passing on. So that's kind of interesting. Some of what's in the Dhammapada might well be the kind of Buddhist equivalent of sayings like a stitch in time saves nine. You can't say with absolute certainty that anything that's in the Pali Canon was definitely said by the Buddha. All you can really do is say, this is not in the Buddhist scriptures, and so you can't legitimately claim that the Buddha said it.
And that seems like a sensible approach. So what's Bodhipaksha's advice, having reflected on this area, for dealing with fake Buddha quotes, or indeed quotes online more generally?
The Buddha was very keen that we practice truthful speech. And I think we have a responsibility to check that what we're passing on is accurate. So I find myself in the situation, for example, where I'll be on social media and I'll see some quote, and it may not be, you know, a Buddhist quote at all. It might be a political quote, you know, something that's ascribed to Donald Trump or something like that. And the first thing I will do is assume that the quote is fake, because a lot of them are. So many of the quotes that I see are actually taken out of context or are distorted in some way. And so before I pass anything on, I'll go and do a little bit of investigation.
I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha is published by Parallax and is available in bookshops now. You can visit fakebuddhaquotes.com to find out more about the book and where it is available. It's an entertaining and humorous read, but also takes the opportunity of calling out the fake quotes to share what the Buddha actually taught. And now moving on from what the Buddha actually taught in India 2,500 years ago to the Dharma, his teaching, being taught in India today. Interestingly, Buddhism had begun to go into decline in India around the 7th century BCE. In the late 19th century, that began to turn around by means of the work of institutions such as the Mahabodhi Society, but also due to the mass conversions into Buddhism of the followers of Dr. Ambedkar, which began on the 14th of October 1956. The India Dhamma Trust is a Triratna charity which exists to help create supportive conditions for Buddhist practice in India. Vajratara is the chair of this trust. We now hear from her about her personal connection with India and a little background on the caste system and untouchability.
My connection with India goes back to when I was 10 years old. I went to India because my friend's father was working there. It was the first time I'd seen really visible poverty to that level. I found it quite shocking. There were some very, very beautiful things in India, particularly the architecture and art, and at the same time some very extreme poverty. That had a very strong effect on me. It was part of a series of events that made me want to devote my life to the spiritual life. I didn't think it was okay that children of my age were living on the streets and in that kind of visible poverty. So there was that, and then very much later I went on pilgrimage with the Order and Movement. Oh, and I also went on an international youth convention and the Order Convention in India. And, you know, got to know some of our Sangha in India and felt very, very inspired by the work that they do there and by the commitment that they have to the Dharma, to the extent of really making choices that were beyond just living a secure life. In India, there's no social security, there's no sort of safety net. And in a way, it echoed my own feelings that I didn't want to live a life purely for security. I wanted to live a life that made a difference to others. They had a lot of confidence that the Dharma really works and can make a difference to people's lives. Actually, Indian society is divided into castes. The higher castes have all the power, basically. Traditionally, in that society, there's the four main castes, and then underneath that are what used to be known as the untouchables. So these are people who were deemed to be polluting just by their birth, and they would be known to be untouchable by any member of the higher castes. They were given the most menial roles, and still are in many places in India, dealing with carcasses of dead animals, dealing with human excrement, things like that. So they were given the most menial tasks, but in a way that was utterly degrading to keep them in their place. I know of someone from that community. He's an artist, and he was drawing depictions of stories he'd even recently heard, for example, of a man whose job it was to clear up the carcasses of dead dogs, having to carry them on his head. But this dog had been dead for maybe a week or something, and he put it on his head, and of course the carcass fell apart. So that said to me, well, it wasn't just being given a dirty job to do, but also, why would you not be given a wheelbarrow to do it? That's the history, and also there's been a lot of a history of violence against women from the scheduled caste, particularly, as a means of social control. And then there's also control in terms of not giving people right to education or knowledge or land or even entry into the temples, so religious, spiritual life.
One person who's had an enormous impact on the landscape of Indian Buddhism and beyond is Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. Dr. Ambedkar has changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in India trapped in the hell of caste for the better. What can we all learn from his example?
Dr. Ambedkar was from that community. He became, through a series of, well, through help from more liberal thinking Maharajas, actually. He got an education and became the most educated man in India. PhD from Columbia University in America and from London School of Economics in London. And he was called to the bar in Gray's Inn. So he was hugely successful, very, very hardworking, with a real passion of he had to help his people. He had to end inequality and particularly untouchability. And the caste system, he said, you know, he wanted to annihilate caste, which we shouldn't really think of as just caste. It's also annihilate inequality, because the way he went about doing that applies to inequality in all cultures. He tried legal means. which have been, you know, very helpful, and economic means and social protest, social action. In the end, he said, there has to be a transformation of heart and mind to remove inequality in the mind. That's why he decided that actually it had to be a religion. But he said that not all religions are worth having. Through careful thought and deliberation, he chose Buddhism because Buddhism has a comprehensive system of morality. It removes inequality from the mind itself. There's so many aspects about who he was as a person. But, you know, he's one of the great social activists, and along with the great heroes of our society, like, you know, Nelson Mandela or people like that. And he's very little known, but actually he did such an enormous amount for other people and totally dedicated his life to that. He could have had a very, very easy life in America or the UK. He could have been a barrister or whatever he wanted to be. He just applied himself. So I think there's a lot we can take from the example of his dedication to inequality and removing inequality in society. I think there's also his confidence about Buddhism having a social aspect to it, that actually Buddhism is not just about our own lives. If we change our lives, it will also have an effect on society, and his confidence in that, and his confidence that to make the Buddha's teachings available to other people is a supreme act of generosity to the world. So he said, we mustn't think the duty of a Buddhist is to be a good Buddhist. We must see that our duty is to spread Buddhism, which is to serve mankind. And that can be a problematic message for the West, because we've got a history of quite cruel and unpleasant history of missionaries. You know, so as a society, we don't really, or as societies, we don't really favour the idea of spreading a religion. But actually, I think we could really reflect on what Dr. Ambedkar said and think to ourselves, well, actually, what would it be like if more people were Buddhists, and take some confidence in that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind, and whether keeping it as a private individual concern is enough. I remember talking to Sangharakshita at one point, and he said, well, one mustn't just look after one's own garden. And I was taking the garden to be one's mind. It's not enough just to tend to our own garden. We have to make that garden available to others. We have to help other people with their gardens.
So it is important not just to tend to our own garden. The Indian Dhamma Trust exemplifies this by raising money to directly support spreading the Dharma in India. Why is this important?
I've said this story a few times, but I'll say it again. There was some terrible caste atrocity in Gujarat. What had happened was some people from the scheduled caste had been publicly beaten in front of a police station and put in on videos on YouTube. I mean, really, really badly beaten and humiliated. In a way, why would you do that? Why would you beat someone in front of a police station and film it on YouTube? It's a sign to say, we don't care. You know, no one's going to touch us. The government isn't going to touch us, and we can do what we like. One answer to that is to have a riot and the people from the scheduled caste community to get their own back. But they decided not to do that. They decided that they were going to embrace a path of peace and a path of social change and transformation of mind and heart. And they embraced Buddhism. So they came to Nagpur, and yeah, there were a few hundred who at that time, I think there'd be more since, who decided to become Buddhists. And it was such a joyful occasion, seeing those people so happy, so confident. And this is happening all over India. But of course, you know, as we know, Buddhism is a path of practice. It requires careful study and training, retreats, classes, workshops, all these things. And Kalyanamitrata, it requires spiritual friendship. So who is going to meet these people? They're embracing the Buddhism. They have that huge enthusiasm for the Dharma. Who's going to respond to that? What the India Dharma Trust does is it raises money outside of India, so that's in the UK and Europe and Australasia and the Americas, to help. Well, basically, we give it to the Indian public preceptors and say, how would you like to spend this? The majority is spent on Dharma workers, you know, not on buildings or equipment and all these sort of things. It's actually spent on people's wages so that they can devote themselves full time to going to meet people who've converted to Buddhism, run retreats, run workshops, and help them train in Buddhism to the level at which they're ready for ordination, and then they can do the same. So that's what we do. It used to be that Dharma work was funded by Karunar, but Karunar Trust felt that they couldn't, rightly so, they couldn't really use money that they'd raised from non-Buddhist to spend on Buddhist projects. In a way, it has to come from people who know the value of Buddhism. The Karunar Trust does social projects, but in a way, the India Dharma Trust is trying to look at the root of the inequality, and it gives rise to the need for social projects and help people practice the Dharma. With the India Dharma Trust, it's a real opportunity to feel part of what's happening in India. And that's what we'd like to do at the India Dharma Trust. It's about raising money, but it's also about raising awareness and a sense of one order and one sangha, where people feel a part of each other's lives because we can benefit so much from each other and what we've got in common in terms of our aspirations and commitment and faith in the Dharma, but also how our lives are different. I think my life is so, so enriched by having contact with the Indian Sangha. I can't imagine my Buddhist practice without it, in a sense. It's really become part of me, and it makes me very, very happy.
So that's all we have in this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. A big thank you to Manisha, Mahashraddha, Bodhipaksha, and Vajratara for their contributions. The music is from Blue Dot Sessions, www.sessions.blue. Stay tuned to thebuddhacentre.com for all the latest news, community highlights and features from across the Triratna world. You can also check out our latest audio offerings, Buddhist Voices podcast and the Buddha Centre Online podcast on your favourite podcast network. Our parting words today are a poem by Bhante, read by Pranigita.
Four gifts. I come to you with four gifts. The first gift is a lotus flower. Do you understand? My second gift is a golden net. Can you recognize it? My third gift is a shepherd's round dance. Do your feet know how to dance? My fourth gift is a garden planted in a wilderness. Could you work there? I come to you with four gifts. Dare you accept them?